Hello, this is Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Charlie Shoemake, jazz vibraphonist extraordinaire, jazz educator, resident of Cambria. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here.
To me, you are a legend, and to a lot of people, not only for your musicianship, but for your promotion of the genre of jazz, and you're interested in young people learning that craft. But I should declare early in the show that I am one of your piano students.
That's true.
So I'm a little bit biased in that regard. Let's talk a little bit about jazz as a musical type or genre. More or less, where are its roots and when did it start in the United States?
Well, you probably know as much about that as I do, Brian. I'm just going from the history books that it seemed to be New Orleans that the first recorded jazz people were known, I guess, in the early 1900s. And then, of course, the popularity of it spread from New Orleans into the other parts of the United States, mostly, I guess, on the East Coast for a long time, Chicago and New York. And people like Louis Armstrong, of course, was the first certified genius of the music, and he spread his influence over the music nationwide, and then later on with recordings worldwide. And I guess you would say New Orleans, but again, that's like 100 and something years ago, and I'm just like yourself, I'm a student of that, reading about it rather than knowing about it. Yeah, so
I think a lot of times that I know all that. Well, what you just said is correct, that you can consider some of the roots of jazz, the blues, for example, and I'm sure the blues were being played in other parts of the United States, especially the Deep South, like
right.
Mississippi Delta. And then a lot of jazz music since forever relates to romantic ballads, and those have been composed and performed for a long time, too.
Sure, Louis Armstrong was doing standards of the day as well as blues pieces. And
an interesting bit of trivia that I read once is that even though jazz was based in New Orleans around World War I, because a lot of the jazz music was happening in places that were less than healthy as far as the Department of War Department, I guess they called it then, they closed a bunch of those places down. And in order to maintain their work, the musicians, I mean, many of them, including, I think, Louis Armstrong, got on a riverboat and went north, and they passed by places like Chicago
sure.
and other points, right. Venue, and it was spread maybe not intentionally, but
right.
really.
Or
really
as Lawrence Welk would call it, World War I.
World War I. how did you get into this profession? I know as a young man you were a baseball star and a multi-sport athlete.
Well, I started playing the piano at age six. My parents got me into the piano, and I loved it. And I also fell in love when I was a little older with baseball, and for a while I was really serious about both. In fact, so much so that I guess I was a first-team All-City high school player in Houston, and I had a scholarship at SMU in Dallas to play baseball, but I was a piano major, which was unheard of, and probably it will never be heard of again. So that was, yeah. I loved the piano, and I was, of course, in Houston at that time in the 40s and early 50s. There was no such thing as jazz instruction. It was all classical studies. And then I started reading some of the magazines that were out, like Downbeat and Metronome, and I started reading about these guys that were like these great jazz artists, and I started listening to their records, and I just fell in love with the music. And I had been, I loved classical music, but I'd never thought of it as a career. But when I started hearing the great jazz players of that period, I really thought, wow, this is something I might like to do, and that's the way it developed.
Now, you and I have talked on other occasions about one can only have so many things in your life that you want to spend time on and do it well. Obviously, you couldn't do big league sports and big league music.
Right. That's true.
But at the same time, you had other interests in life and weren't able to or didn't want to devote yourself only to the music. And so you had a life besides that, a marriage and other interests.
Well, that's true. But my of course, Sandy and I have been going on now 59 years of marriage, so yeah, that obviously that worked out pretty well. But Sandy was very understanding because she's an artist herself, and one of the things that I've noticed with a lot of the people in music, both jazz and classical, is that when they have problems with their relationships, it's because the other person can't equate it with the fact that they're the person's person, but music is their thing, and they're separate things. And so a lot of people confuse that they want everything to be like a young lady would want complete attention at all times, and that's not going to happen, because I think you and I discussed, we had a concert in our jazz series recently where we had this fantastic young trombone player from Los Angeles, Andy Martin, perform. And you and I discussed it. I mean, with him, there was nothing else but music. It has to be that way to play like that. I mean,
right. You can
be a fine musician and a fine player and enjoy the music thoroughly, but if you're going to be competing at that level, there's got to be nothing else. And I knew that when I was at SMU on this baseball. I let the scholarship go because I realized I couldn't do both. So it had to get to the big leagues, either in sports or in music, in the arts, it has to be that and nothing else. You've just got to like devote your entire being to it.
We want to make clear that Sandy Shoemake, your very talented and lovely wife, mm-hmm. who's with us in the studio today, she was a musician as well.
That's right. Well, that's where I met Sandy. She was the vocalist with the Cy Zentner Orchestra. They were appearing at the Palladium in Hollywood and all over the West Coast. And so we met at a rehearsal, and she was on the intermission of the rehearsal. She was playing the piano, and I went over and started talking to her, and that's how we got together. Yeah.
And so the two of you were able to partly, I mean, not only have your careers, but get along because you both understood the business.
Exactly.
And its requirements.
Yeah. And supportive of one another, and not there was never, people have often asked us, well, wasn't there a competition? And there never was with us. I wonder though, both of us have done, I think, without bragging, we've had pretty nice careers, but neither one of us became so huge that that would have been a problem. And I can see that would be. I mean, if somebody. If somebody was as big as Frank Sinatra or as big as Peggy Lee or something, then that could be a problem if the partner was not as big. And so with us, it was kind of like commensurate. We were both about the same as far as notoriety and acceptance and so forth. Yeah.
In your lifetime, you have seen jazz metamorphose into a bunch of different areas. Your book that you use for your piano students, in which I have at home, is entitled Playing Bebop.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, bebop as a style of jazz, which began, early 1940s,
mm-hmm.
mid-40s,
right.
Was the latest thing back then. Why, just I'll throw this out, why pick bebop as the focus for the book, or what makes that stand out for you as an important musical genre to study?
I think that a lot of it depends on the era that you come up in. I think young people today, there's an awful lot of young people that want to understand bebop. Of course, Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and Fats Navarro and some of the greatest players of that early period hated that term. They absolutely hated the word bebop because it sounds like, I don't know, it sounds small or not significant. Whereas modern jazz, I think, but of course, how long can it be modern? So now that was started, as you said, in the 40s, and now we're in 2017. So is that still considered modern? Well, to me it is. That would be, I'm sure, in people in the classical composition world, to them, I'm sure Ravel and Bartok are not modern, but to me they are. That music seems, it took a step with all the possibilities, especially harmonically. And what's happened since that time in a lot of areas, a lot of young people today still want to play in that style because it's so difficult to master, but they're also interested in other styles that much of the music that Charlie Parker played was in 4/4 time, rhythmically. And now a lot of young people like to play songs in 7/4 and 13/4 and all kinds of odd time signatures, trying to just change it, doing something different than what's been done before, which I understand. For me, the music that Charlie Parker and Bud Powell created is still viable, and it's still the most fun for me to play and to listen to. So that's why I'm still, that's why I got into it, and that's why I'm still into it.
Makes a lot of sense. I want to come back to bebop because I think there's several other issues that are so vital and important, not only within the music, but how it was received by the American public. But if you go back to the early 1900s, the early bands, I assume would be pretty much wind instruments, maybe with a banjo, and
right,
pretty much all blacks from the South, but mm-hmm, eventually, not too far into it, white musicians got involved.
Dick Spiderbeck and people like that, yes.
And New Orleans Rhythm Kings, people like that. Mm-hmm. And I suppose those musicians got together and played. But in those days, if you're going to do that, it had to be after hours and behind closed doors.
That's true. There was a problem, and that lasted for a long time. Even in the 40s, when the modern period really began, it was very odd for Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie to have Al Haig in their band. But he was in there, a white pianist, but he was in there because he was the best guy they could get. That was it. And there was no feeling of color, or the feeling was, how good is he? And that was it, which it should be always. But sometimes, you know, as then and now, there are problems with that for some people.
Absolutely. And so then moving, say, through the 1920s with what we might call traditional jazz, or later on with a so-called Dixieland revival, the Dixieland music, which, again, based in New Orleans. But a lot of the jazz got taken over by the big band movement.
Right.
And it wasn't just a combo of 4 or 8 musicians, but maybe 25 musicians.
That's true.
Big bands.
That's true. But, of course, then Benny Goodman was noted for bringing in the mixture of the races. Like, in his band, though they did not play in the big band, but he always featured as a side part of his concerts or as his dances, Lionel Hampton on the vibraphone and Teddy Wilson on the piano. So that was, and that was unheard of in the 30s. So that was a breakthrough. Yeah.
Right. I in fact, I've heard some people say that his small groups are maybe even better than in many cases than the big band recordings.
Well, they're probably more creative, and there's more room for creativity and improvisation.
And I know there were a few other musicians who were not happy with the race barriers and broke them when they could, like Artie Shaw.
Right, exactly. And with Billie Holiday and people like, yes.
Courageous people.
Right.
So you had jazz, which probably was the most popular music for young people from the 1920s through the 1940s. You heard it on college campuses, and you could dance to it.
That's
but
true.
But things changed.
Things changed, and it became a more virtuosic kind of music. Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Powell, Al Haig. You had to have an enormous technique on your instrument to be able to handle what they were doing. And also it became more complicated harmonically and rhythmically in every part of the way. It was interesting. I read an article once. It was a book that Aaron Copland wrote. And he was mentioning, because he was a fan of Bud Powell and Charlie Parker, and he noted that their acceptance in the general public was hard, just like when Bartok and Stravinsky came on. That separated a lot of people from, and, you know, I've gotten to know a little bit, not as well as I would like, Andre Previn. And Andre Previn, when he was the conductor of the L.A. Philharmonic, would always program Bartok or Stravinsky first and Mozart last, because then the older people that didn't like it couldn't walk out.
That is so interesting. I'd like to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by jazz vibraphonist and jazz educator Charlie Shoemake. You mentioned a minute ago, Charlie, that American classical composers, many of them, were big jazz fans. But we also know that a lot of the jazz stars of the 20s were big fans of classical music of that era.
Yeah, it's true, yes, and that's remained to this very day, yeah.
including the more surrealistic or impressionistic like Ravel
and
others.
Yeah.
But because, and I'm guessing now, but because the music became more complicated, it maybe took more of an effort, after the mid-1940s to appreciate the music, and then probably in most cases you couldn't dance to it.
That's true. I think a lot of the tempos were blazing fast, and it was like really a concert atmosphere as opposed to a dance atmosphere. I think, you know, the group that I was with for so many years with George Shearing, that was a more danceable kind of concept. He had great appeal with a large audience. I mean, George Shearing's quintet, the first recording he made sold over 1 million copies, which is unheard of today for any music like that. But it was geared. It just was the music of the day. To me, and I think Artie Shaw mentioned this, that was a meeting ground where that was the best music that was popular ever. Then it broke away and into fragments of this and that and the other. So now that jazz is more sophisticated, obviously it's got a smaller audience.
Right. And I should mention here that George Shearing, everybody knows him and his fame and his talent, but his distinctive sound, which probably nobody else could duplicate, not only his piano skills, but the instrumentation with the guitar and the vibraphone,
right,
and everything else, which is so special.
He was an innovator. He really was.
And you were with that group for 7 years.
That's right.
And you left the group primarily because?
Family considerations. Sandy and I have one son. And at that time, he was going into junior high school, and I just couldn't stay on the road like I was. George's road work could be severe. I mean, we'd have these like 14, 15-week tours, and Sandy and I worked it out so that she would always come out and see me after 2 or 3 weeks, so we were never apart that long. But still, it was tough, and for him, we even took our son out of school a lot during my years with George, and obviously when he got into junior high, that wasn't going to work anymore. So I didn't want to leave because I love the group and I love being with George, but I had to do it. And when I did, that's when the teaching thing started, because before I went with George, I had done Hollywood studio work, like for playing the percussion for a lot of the television work and movies. And I didn't want to get back into that because I had made a name for myself in the jazz world and I loved it so much that I thought, well, there must be some way. The problem with that is that when you play jazz, if you don't travel, you're not going to make a living. You can't stay in one place all the time. But I thought if I had put so much time into my playing and learning that I thought, well, possibly I could teach. And that's when I started in 73. And that obviously proved to be very successful, and I'm still doing it today.
So. Now, over that time, you've had a couple of thousand students.
I don't know if it's that. Sandy and I logged it in during the L.A. days. It's probably close to 1,500, so it's up there. And since then, I started back again 5 years ago up here on the Central Coast. And so I guess, I don't know, maybe 1,500, 1,600, somewhere in there. Yeah.
What do you see? I mean, we assume, what drives you to be a jazz educator? I mean, what moves you?
Well, I have to be honest with you. To tell you the truth, at the beginning, it was just to make a living.
Right.
So I could be bringing some cash into our house. But then it did that for us. It provided a nice income for us down in Los Angeles. But then I really started enjoying it a lot. It never has been a chore for me. I enjoy it. Obviously, with that many people, you meet a cross section of talents and drive and desire and it's almost like being a psychiatrist in a way. I mean, you get to meet people and you really get to know inside them, because the art does that, and I've enjoyed it. It's been a real fulfilling thing for me.
Wouldn't you also say that your students, maybe unwittingly, but they become ambassadors for the music?
I think so, yeah. I mean, certainly, the ones that I've done that have become like really big names like Ted Nash's star solos with the Lincoln Center Orchestra, and this young player that we mentioned, Andy Martin, the trombone player that just played up here recently. I mean, they are great illustrations of what can be done with this music.
I was lucky enough to be at the Andy Martin concert, and everybody in the audience was swaying back and forth or tapping their foot or obviously having a good time, caught up in the moment. And I thought to myself at the time that this is the highest and best use of all of our times, the musicians, the audience, the instruments. I mean, there's no place I'd rather be than in the embrace of that music.
Someone came up to me. I've never had anybody say this to me before, but I don't know if it was that concert or it might have been the one later with Tom Rainier, when they said, and this beautiful piano at Painted Sky that Steve has, this Kawhi, big 7'4" Kawhi Grant, that piano must have been enjoying this.
I know.
getting to have this come out of its own belly. You know, like it was, as I laughed at it, that was funny.
I sort of feel the same way. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk just a little bit about, I don't know, what makes jazz or the essence of jazz. To me, it is more complex. Sort of a tension and release thing. What would your definition be?
Well, it's just the same as any music, Brian. It's only three elements that you're dealing with: melody, rhythm, and harmony. And so you're trying to, in jazz, I think that every one of those is so equally important. And you have to really learn how to master all of them if you're going to. Of course, jazz is really composition, but it's instant composition. You could be some of the classical people or, you know, sit and they could worry over the next measure for a month, whereas in jazz, I mean, you've got about a split second to make your move. And so that's one of the things that I enjoyed about it. It's an old cliche now, but, I mean, it's America. Jazz is America's classical music. So that's what it was born here, and it's been developed here, and now it's our art form. I just wish, you know, as we've talked earlier, I wish it was more accepted by a larger group, but that's something that everybody's still trying. We'll always try to improve.
Right. If we don't hear much of it on the radio, we are lucky enough to have the concert halls, universities, other venues. I should mention that you and Sandy offer regular concerts at the Painted Sky Studios in Cambria. Sometimes they occur at your house. Sometimes
at Unity Church down here locally. In San Luis. Yeah, yeah. We had a place. Of course, everyone knows this. We had a place called the Hamlet up in Cambria on Highway 1. It was fantastic. We did that for over 20 years. And that was the place for the famous jazz artist series. But unfortunately, the owners passed away, and it was sold. And a gentleman that bought it was not into music at all and redesigned it so there could be no music, which is really a tragedy. But so after that, we moved the series around a little bit. We were in Paso for a while, and now we're back in Cambria. But we're mostly at Painted Sky and Main Street in Cambria. But also, we do concerts at our home, and we also do them at Unity Church down in San Luis. So it's kind of a travelogue as far as the series. But it's always here on the Central Coast.
And if you belong to the Jazz Federation, as I do, you'll get regular email updates about your concerts as well as other things going on. I do want to highlight the fact that you are a featured artist in a recently produced and lovely book by Anthony Smith, Masters of the Vibes, and some of the top vibraphonists of the day, like Gary Burton and Terry Gibbs. You're in there, and that must have been an honor for you.
It was a thrill, and I'll be honest with you. I was really gratified that I was chosen to be one of the main people in there with a large chapter, and I'm the only one from the West Coast that's in there. Most of the people, for some reason or other, that's another conundrum, is I don't know why, but the jazz media is mostly powerful on the East Coast, some of the great artists out here on the West Coast don't get a lot of notoriety, and so for me to be in there as large a life as I was, I was very pleased about that.
Yeah, it seems like that was true maybe even back in the 40s and 50s, whoever was doing their thing on the West Coast was maybe by definition not quite as good as East Coast, New York people.
In the old days, Downbeat magazine, which was a big big Bible for media, for music, had a representative on the West Coast who reported regularly about that, but that doesn't happen anymore.
Tell me, remind me of the name. My son Nathaniel and I attended the concert at the Union Hall in L.A., like sort of an covering and honoring Charlie Parker, the invasion, bebop invades the West Coast.
That was the Los Angeles Jazz Society, and they put on concerts from time to time, and they have themes of their concerts. So that theme was December of 1945, when modern jazz or bebop came to from New York out to California, and the band was Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Milt Jackson, Al Haig, Ray Brown, and Stan Levy. And so they tried to recreate that. And of course, all those people have passed away. But so they had the people that are playing today that emulate that style of playing and can do that. And I was chosen to do it. I was the Milt Jackson part.
Right. I remember being there for that. And the energy in the room went up, 200% the minute you guys started playing.
Yeah, that was a nice, nice evening, nice concert.
If you could, what would you say to somebody who, let's say an acquaintance or a friend, and they tell you, well, Charlie, with all due respect, I just don't like jazz. What would you say to them?
Well, what I get most of the time is people say, I don't like jazz because I don't understand it. And for me, that's funny because right now, as you well know, studying with me, I mean, I know a lot about it, like chords, scales, this, that, and what this, all, everything. You could go over to the piano and hit a chord, and I could tell you exactly what it is.
And which movie the song came from.
All of that. But you know what? Here's the thing. When I was 10 years old and I heard jazz, I didn't know any of that. I just liked it.
Yeah.
I didn't have to know any of that. And our audience at all the concerts that we do, we have one coming up this Sunday at our home with the great saxophone player from the East Coast, Greg Abate. But anyway, when I heard the music, I just liked it. And the people that come to our concerts, they don't know that. They don't know what chord that is. They don't know if it's a dominant 13 or anything. But they just like the music.
Right.
They have a chip in their brain that is able to accept good music, and that's the audience that we need to expand if we can.
I think you and I have joked about that you and I must have been in the same line in terms of getting that chip, because I think one of the biggest disappointments my dad ever had, telling him my favorite music was jazz, even though I love classical, I love opera, I love Norteño Mexican music, but jazz is just the be-all and end-all, and it's a big tent. Right. Everybody from Tony Bennett to Frank Sinatra and John Coltrane.
Obviously, he couldn't hear that.
No, not in this time. It's really been a pleasure. This has been Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we were joined by Charlie Shoemake, jazz vibraphonist, jazz educator, also a resident of Cambria. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.